Welcome back to Food Toxicology. I'm Greg Muller, the instructor for the course. Well, perhaps in the last century or so, no food toxicosis incident has touched more hearts, perhaps, than the Minamata incident in Japan. This particular incident involved mercury in the human food chain, the title of our today's lecture. It involved mercury in an extraordinarily dramatic, multi-generational impact that directly affected well over 10,000 Japanese citizens. Unfortunately, before that time, we didn't have the necessary knowledge in terms of the biogeochemistry of mercury and the potential food chain effects of mercury. Mercury released in this particular case from an industrial process contaminating local food systems. This is a heart-wrenching rendition of food toxicosis in the dramatic impacts of human suffering associated with a contaminant. It's an unfortunate part of our human history. But today what we're going to do is try to explore the whole concept of mercury and the human food chain and bring you up to speed a little bit with the current regulatory and food safety status. Our learning objectives here today, we're going to try to explore the background and some of the history of mercury, a very interesting element. We'll try to understand it in an environmental biogeochemistry context. How does mercury cycle through the environment? How does it work its way up through the food chain? As I said, we're going to try to look at mercury from all different points of view in terms of its environmental biogeochemistry. One of the most important parts is the toxicity profile of methylmercury, the most toxic member of the biogeochemical cycle of mercury. We're going to use the Minamata incident and its role in understanding the risk of mercury in terms of a historical context of some of the clinical disease manifestations of mercury toxicosis. What happens when things go terribly, terribly wrong in terms of the relationship of industry and a local community's food system. We'll try as well to review some current research. This is research that's happened in the past 10 years or so, looking at the relationship between mercury and specifically methylmercury in the food system and child development. We'll try to as well understand some of the current regulatory findings, the upshot, if you will, in terms of mercury in its environment and how we use that information to manage mercury in the food chain. Well, mercury's history is quite colorful, to say the least. In fact, it is the red color of many old and ancient manuscripts and paintings. Mercury sulfide, the sulfides being extremely stable and in mineral form as cinnabar or vermilion, is the native mercury found in nature, the red rocks, if you will. When you see an ancient manuscript that's got colorful illuminations in it, the reds are typically cinnabar or mercury sulfide. The ancients used to find a pretty red rock, grind it up with an oil base, and that became a paint or an ink. In terms of its history, there was ancient mining of mercury and its ores in Spain, Italy, and China. It was found in 1500 BC in Egyptian tombs. It was even recognized in antiquity that working the mines associated with mercury, if not a death sentence, it sure was not a good livelihood. In terms of native mercury, it is occasionally found in nature, argentum vivum. It's also found in terms of early alchemy as from condensed heating vapor of cinnabar. And this was referred to as water silver in the Greek, or hydrogyrum. In terms of the role of alchemy in the utilization of mercury, it was pretty substantial. One of the earliest Latin alchemy texts, the Turba Philosophorum, or Assembly of the Alchemical Philosophers, dates to the 12th century. In that particular document, the quotes are, "In the estimation of all sages, mercury is the first principle of all metals. As flesh is generated from coagulated blood, so gold is generated out of coagulated mercury." And so this is the relationship that you probably have read of in terms of alchemy and mercury to gold. In terms of the global cycle of mercury, we've understood this through a lot of environmental chemistry and toxicology analyses research over the past 50 years. This cartoon gives you an idea of the cycling. We start off with the degassing of mercury from soil, rocks, and surface water. Mercury is a natural element. It's in many rock formations in trace amounts or in some ore deposits in fairly high concentrations, approaching percent levels. That degassing, as well as emissions from volcanic or from human activities such as burning fossil fuels, burning coal, for example, starts a volatilization cycle. It moves in gaseous form through the atmosphere. There can be ionization having to do with photochemical effects and interaction with cloud vapor. There is a deposition then in terms of mercury on land and surface waters, and this transboundary transport is part of the problem in terms of worldwide deposition of mercury from one source to perhaps lands distant, and it's a concern in terms of the U.S. Monitoring of our own ecosphere. What happens in soil and water is that this mercury gets converted into soluble mercury sulfides. Some of these mercury salts and chemicals can actually be incorporated into microbial flora and fauna. What happens is there is a bioalkylation as microbes and fungi and various life forms detoxify mercury. They convert it to methylmercury forms. There can be, at that point in time, an atmospheric cycling of methylmercury because it is a volatile alkylated heavy metal. In terms of the aquatic mercury cycle, what happens is we find that the relatively harmless salts of mercury in its elemental, divalent, or particulate forms are actually converted to methylmercury CH3HG+. And that becomes the major potential for toxicity. Methylmercury is a byproduct of the metabolic processes of sulfate-reducing bacteria, or SRBs, that use sulfate as a terminal electron acceptor in their anaerobic respiratory process. It's not known exactly how inorganic mercury is converted into organic mercury into the process, but there's been a lot of research done to try to understand exactly what happens in terms of this particular chemical. Once it's in the methylmercury form, it is a chemical that is bioaccumulated because it does have lipophilicity. So it's bioaccumulated in the normal progression of bioaccumulation and potential biomagnification in aquatic ecosystems. In the modern environment, we find that about 70% of the mercury comes from anthropogenic sources, and these include metal mining and smelting. Smelting being the process of making an element from a raw ore that's typically an oxide or a sulfide, for example. We find that incineration processes, not only incineration or combustion of coal, but incineration of municipal and medical waste materials. Coal-fired power plants and cement manufacturing are both major vectors in terms of release of atmospheric mercury. Volcanic eruption and just mining activities in terms of turning over the soil do release any volatile mercury residues. With industrialization has come an enhanced release of mercury. It's been estimated that there has been a threefold increase in environmentally available mercury due to industrialization. Because mercury is what's referred to as a PBT, it is persistent, bioaccumulative, and toxic. It's of great concern. There's about 10 to 12 chemicals that carry the label of persistent, bioaccumulative, and toxic in terms of EPA recognition. Mercury is one of the most toxic, most concerned elements on that particular list. Now, we've used mercury for several centuries in many industrial processes. It has a unique, it's a liquid metal, so it conducts electricity, and we've used that in its simplest form as elemental mercury to measure temperature and pressure. We've all seen, perhaps in our laboratory activities, mercury barometers or mercury thermometers. These days, the use of mercury in common household thermometers is not encouraged because of its potential release. When I was growing up, mercury in thermometers was a relatively common occurrence. Mercury acts as a biocide. That should give us a hint that it's got potential toxic properties. Phenylmercurics are very potent biocides that have been used for various applications. It's a preservative and disinfectant, and it's been used in industrial processes to catalyze various chemical reactions. You'll find it in lighted athletic shoes running down the street, and scientific apparatus, and some batteries, various old latex and oil-based paints. There's been several documented case studies of individuals, house painters, that have become intoxicated from mercury from just using just the preservatives, mercury-based preservatives, that used to be used in house paint, actually up until relatively recently. There was a strong push to pull the mercury out. The idea was latex is a protein. It has the potential to have mold growth. The mercury was put in these paints to inhibit the growth of microbial and mold growth. There's various pesticides and solvents that have been used with mercury. There's dyes and pigments. You'll see it in the arts as a red pigment typically. It has had active use in medicine as a pharmaceutical. There are various mercury compounds used in a wide variety of applications. One of the most contentious use is its use as a preservative in most, if not all, of the vaccines that are currently administered. The idea being that this is an intravenous injection of a relatively trace amount. Unfortunately, the use of this particular thimerosal preservative has not found a suitable replacement in terms of it trying to preserve the shelf-stable nature of vaccines. In terms of mercury's history, we see it out and about in terms of our intersection and examination of history. You recall from your reading of Alice in Wonderland, the Mad Hatter. The Mad Hatter was a social term, and it had a lot to do with the fact that when beaver pelts were used in 19th century, the actual working of the pelts in terms of making them into hats used a mercury preservative. People that worked in these shops and factories making these hats would have mercury toxicosis. They would find them to be irritable at least in terms of the neurotoxic impacts of the mercury and mercuric nitrate that they were exposed to. In terms of its use as a medicine, in the 19th century there was a substantial amount of heavy metal use as medicinals for various applications. One of those applications was the treatment of syphilis. There were severe side effects and many deaths associated with that. They have been used as diuretics, anti-invectives, laxatives, and eye and skin treatments. When I was growing up, there was an iodine solution called Mercurochrome that was available over the counter. There was a mercury compound in there as antimicrobicidal that was used in directly put on cuts and scrapes in the same way that perhaps students of this class use a compound like Neosporin or some antibiotic cream. Mercurochrome was something that we grew up with. There's been some speculation in terms of the role of mercury toxicity in the medicines during the Lewis and Clark expedition 200 years ago. In fact, Meriwether Lewis did commit suicide following a bout of manic depression. People have looked back at the amounts of mercury in terms of the journals of Lewis and Clark, the amount that was on the trip and the amount that was taken as a medicine because of all of the gastrointestinal upsets associated with their journey. There is some forensic analysis suggesting that indeed Meriwether Lewis actually succumbed to mercury toxicosis. Mercury has, in terms of its target organ toxicology, it's nephrotoxic. It exerts its principal nephrotoxic effect on the membrane of the proximal tubule. It'll bind to the sulfhydryl groups on membrane proteins, so it creates a folded or a coagulated protein. It acts as a diuretic in terms of inhibiting sodium reabsorption in the tubules. In recent history, in the 1920s to 1960s, organomercurials were used clinically as diuretics to enhance fluid release because sodium was not reabsorbed. Currently, there's still some compounds like Mersal, which is a C13H17 mercury nitrate compound, which is used in a clinical setting as a diuretic. The prime mode of toxicosis associated with mercury is the neurotoxicity of methylmercury. All forms of mercury are neurotoxic, but methylmercury is regarded as highly neurotoxic. The levels of methylmercury are too low to show a postnatal effect can become neurotoxic to a developing fetus. In terms of our exposure, the principal exposure in the human diet to methylmercury is through fish consumption, although we find it also in various sea mammals and shellfish. The major source of methylmercury in the aquatic environment is atmospheric deposition of mercury onto the surfaces, and then it is biomethylated again by microorganisms and magnified up the food chain. The U.S. Concentrations of most of the fish caught in regional waters, and this has a lot to do with our restrictions on discharging of mercury into natural waters. Typically, it's less than about a half of a milligram per kilogram, or half of a part per million. Some species of fish, and typically the fish that are at the top of the aquatic food chain, such as tuna, shark, and swordfish, appear to have levels that are greater than a part per million. So there is a bioaccumulation and a bioconcentration. Because of the potential for neurotoxicity and impact on developing fetuses, pregnant women are always advised not to eat the larger predatory fish, such as tuna, shark, and swordfish, while they are pregnant. Methylmercury exposure to infants and children, it can happen via in utero, but also exposure due to breastfeeding and from consumption of fish and fish products, primarily in terms of infant and child exposure. In terms of methylmercury poisoning incidents, there's been several that have highlighted the potential toxicity of this particular form of mercury. In the late 1950s, what happened was there was an incident in Minamata and Niigata, Japan. There were over 21,000 individuals who filed claims under poisoning because of this. We're going to examine the Minamata incident in detail in this lecture. In 1971 and 1972, there was a poisoning outbreak in Iraq that resulted from the consumption of grain that was used in bread making. This grain had been actually treated as seed grain with a methylmercury fungicide. About 6,500 individuals were affected. About 440 of those actually died. Now, recently, we've kind of come full circle in the whole Minamata incident. This is a October 15, 2004, Associated Press report I won't read it here to you. I'm putting it in the case file just so that the students will have an idea of the current events associated with Minamata and how an event in the 1950s is somewhat still active in terms of the cycle of the potential, the tragic human impact of this toxicosis. In essence, this was an announcement of the final settlement of the Japanese government to the victims of Minamata disease. Minamata disease and the whole incident in terms of Minamata happened at a time when individuals were, I guess, in the post-World War II days, post-industrialization in the run-up to World War II and the time afterwards, when people were just becoming a little bit more linked to their environment and the potential impacts of many of our industrial processes on the environment. Significant among these, in the same way Rachel Carson identified many of the concerns of agricultural chemical use, there was W. Eugene Smith, a photojournalist that actually went to Japan to document some of the horrors associated with Minamata disease. This photojournalist in his book, Minamata Life, Sacred and Profane, essentially documented the pain, suffering, and anguish of the local communities. His photos still to this day document the tremendous human pain and suffering associated with this incident. Out of respect for the individuals, and now that some of the Minamata sufferers have actually suggested that there have been perhaps a desensitization of individuals and the linkage between the individual pain, I've chosen in terms of the lecture not to show any of W. Eugene Smith's pictures, but this is a picture of him with a classic Tomoko in her bath photo in the background that is sufficiently blurred out. Now, Minamata disease, we can define that as a neurological disorder caused by ingestion of large quantities of fish or shellfish that was contaminated with methylmercury, and this was a result of the industrial effluence in Minamata Bay and near a river in Niigata, Japan. What we can learn if we take a look at this before we talk about this specific case is for the first time in Minamata, we were exposed to the impact of mercury pollution and how this creates a serious hazard for humans. The health and environment considerations must be integrated in the process of economic and industrial development from an very early stage. This aspect of the relationship of a community to the industries that the community survives on is a part of the learning curve that we had with the Minamata incident. Now, I've given on the next two slides a chronology related to Minamata disease. First started in terms of 1956. There was reports of a disease to the public health authorities in Japan. There was, over the next 10 or 12 years, an analysis, a research, if you will, trying to link what this disease and what the cause of this new disease was. At the time, we just didn't know the impacts of mercury, although early on there was some suspicions that it was a foodborne illness. It took about 10 years for the companies involved with the discharge to actually change their particular process. It was an acetaldehyde manufacturing process that used mercury as a catalyst. This gives you a continuation of the chronology up through the 70s in terms of some of the court actions of the individuals looking for economic relief from their pain and suffering. Finally, in 1990, they actually started in 1976, the dredging of the sediment, and they finally finished it in 1990. So it took well over a decade to be able to remove the source of the toxicosis from this particular area. Now, when this first happened, there was the link between dose response or cause and effect was not clear. The disease that was prevalent at the time that caused similar neurotoxic syndromes was encephalitis, perhaps followed by a chemical intoxication. It became clear that the disease manifested by the Minamata inhabitants was different. There was some assumption that there was chemical poisoning occurring, and it had a lot to do with the families, the households, the men and women in the houses that became sick, but not only the individuals eating from the table, but the pets that were fed scraps started exhibiting the same sort of neurotoxic signs and symptoms. And so this linkage between pet food and human food gave us a little bit of the cause and effect in terms of something in the food, something in the diet, in the human food chain in this area was linked to this particular disease. Taking into consideration all of the distribution and the chronological organization of the victims, it was surmised that the waste discharge of two industrial plants were the cause of the particular disease manifestation. At the beginning, because it was a chemical plant, mercury was not necessarily considered as the top toxin of choice in terms of cause and effect. There were many other chemicals because of the manufacturing processes in these plants. This peculiar disease actually was something that was new in terms of seeing high dose methylmercury in a human population. This gives you an idea of the methylmercury and how it's used, how mercury is used in acetaldehyde manufacturing. This particular process in the plant, this is from some of the Japanese Ministry of the Environment documents from a decade or two ago. Here's the plant discharging mercury compounds, and it gets bioaccumulated up the food chain, and then you've got human consumption on this end in terms of the stick figures from this particular representation. Now, our formal clinical knowledge was about mercury in industrial settings, not methylmercury. Methylmercury is a biotransformed form of mercury. It's bioalkylated, and environmental toxicologists and biologists suspect that microbes and animals biomethylate as a detoxification or a biotransformation of the toxic properties of this particular heavy metal. It took about 12 years for an official conclusion to come out that it was methylmercury for the Minamata disease outbreak. The scientific knowledge at that point in time was limited in terms of diseases of mercury, and the techniques for analyzing these very small concentrations of mercury in the human diet were also not well developed and not particularly sensitive. So again, to determine cause and effect, you have to make that linkage. It took a significant amount of time, over a decade, to make that linkage. The conclusions came out in 1968 when the Japanese government actually, from the research available and the knowledge available at that point in time, confirmed in an official statement acknowledging that Minamata disease is a disease of the central nervous system caused by a methylmercury compound, making that linkage to the manufacturing discharge of the Chisso Company and the Showa Senko Company, which was upstream in the Agano River, the other location of Minamata disease. The two outbreaks that occurred were on the western side of the Japanese mainland, main island, down in Minamata Bay is where the Chisso factory was. The other factory was upstream in the Agano River, and it was all along here that people were experiencing some sort of toxicosis related to the local food chain. It's estimated that some Minamata inhabitants ate food of about 300 to 1500 grams per day with an average mercury concentration of 3 to 4 micrograms per gram. And this led to their mercury toxicosis. The fact that we had a localized food system in terms of local production Catching of a lot of fish and shellfish for the local markets occurred in the regional bays. The fishermen would go out in the local harbors and the local offshore waters and bring back somewhat local catches, and there was a cycling within the local community. In terms of the distribution of certified patients, you can kind of look at the Agano River up here, and the bubble diagram here, these large pink bubbles give you an idea that it was actually mostly in the larger cities here in the estuary of the river, and also here in Minamata Bay in the city of Minamata. Again, a population sort of dose response linkage here. In terms of the contamination levels in fish, I have two graphics here from the Japan Ministry of the Environment. On the top one from the Agano River Basin, you can see that some of the fish that had concentrations of total mercury as high as 6 part per million in there. In the Minamata Bay area, the average concentration was 4, although there's been observations at 16 and 9 part per million. So significant levels of mercury in local fish stock. In terms of the environmental pollution control that was ordered in terms of source abatement, there was a cessation of the process, the catalyst process using mercury. There was a control put on the industrial effluents. There was environmental restoration over a period of 10 or 15 years that removed the contaminated sediments from the river basin and also from Minamata Bay. And there were restrictions in terms of local fishing and intake of fish or other seafoods from the contaminated areas. In terms of the clinical presentation of Minamata disease and the related syndromes, we find that there was a sensory disorder in the distal portion of the four extremities. So this is a neuropathy apparent in your fingers and toes. There was cerebral ataxia, inability to walk, a lot of stumbling, constriction of the visual field, disorder of ocular movement, a central hearing impairments, and a disequilibrium, a generalized disequilibrium. In terms of the presentation of infant Minamata disease, this had an intellectual disorder, and there was a various degrees of neurological disorders subsequent to ataxia. There were signs and symptoms of acquired Minamata disease, and acquired Minamata disease from being primarily children or adults that consumed large amounts of food, as opposed to infant Minamata disease, which was an infant and embryonic exposure. One of the signs observed in typical Minamata disease patients was a musculature contracture of the fingers shown in this particular patient. This is typical of many forms of neurological damage, including spinal cord severing. This slide gives a fairly developed and in-depth neuropathology of chronic occurrence of Minamata disease. I'm not going to go through this other than to say that the presentation, the clinical presentation, was a degenerative process of the neurons in terms of the number and the function, as well as the morphology of the brain matter over a period of time following the period of dosing. So some of this actually happened in terms of its occurrence years later following the dose interval significantly earlier. In terms of congenital Minamata disease, this is from pregnant women who ate contaminated fish products, and they themselves perhaps manifested mild or no symptoms, but they ended up giving birth to babies with severe developmental disabilities. These included cerebral palsy, retardation, and seizures. This particular outcome, called congenital Minamata disease, was first time that the sensitivity of the developing fetus in terms of the neurotoxic potential of mercury and methylmercury compounds. Following the outbreaks, there were 22 cases of congenital pneumonia disease. This is a second generation disease. The level of prenatal exposure was never ascertained because the individuals, the parents, the mother in this case, were never really able to identify dose response in terms of their own disease. The diagnosis of pneumonia disease can be caused, is confusing perhaps because several of the clinical symptoms can be found in other disease diagnoses. So methylmercury is somewhat broadly neurotoxic and has a challenging range of symptoms in terms of classification. What they did in Japan was actually to look at a rating scale of many of the clinical signs and symptoms associated with known progressive methylmercury disease as it was studied in some patients that had very large-scale presentation of clinical signs and symptoms, and tried to relate it to others to validate and verify the scope of toxicosis over a substantial number of people. Well over 10,000. In terms of a criteria for postnatal pneumonia disease, these are some of the symptoms in terms of the classification standard A, B, C, D. Some of the symptoms included sensory system disorders, ataxia, disequilibrium, constriction of the visual field, CNS, ocular system disorders, and various other symptoms. And this allowed for diagnosis of whether or not this was pneumonia disease or some of the other illnesses that might affect the population. Some of these other diseases with similar presentation included polyneuritis of various origins, cerebral vascular disturbances, cervical spondylosis, and psychogenic disorders of varying kinds. This chart is pretty complex, but what it gives you an idea is the frequency of signs and symptoms. These are 23 symptoms. I've listed them down here. Again, I'm not going to go through this. This is for your own reading. But the idea in terms of the frequency of various types of signs and symptoms, this is 0 to 100% in the pneumonia patients. For example, 1, 2, and 3 are constriction of the visual field, sensory disturbance and deep sensory disturbance, number 4, ataxia. And so you can see that this pretty much covers all of the patients associated with pneumonia disease. In terms of treatment for methylmercury poisoning, there was no specific effective therapy for this disease. There are some chelating reagents or medicines that are used. These typically are ones that we've talked about before in this course for heavy metal treatment, things like penicillin, EDTA complexes to help speed the elimination. These are competitive chelators that help enhance the elimination of mercury. In terms of the environmental response, the dredging of Minamata Bay involved about 70 to 150 tons of mercury contaminated materials. Over the years that the plant was in operation, these particular materials were dredged up from the bay and actually deposited on one of the outstretched regions, local regions, to get it out of the aquatic ecosystem and into a terrestrial environment. Then it can be actually stabilized and treated. In terms of the dredging of Minamata Bay, you can see the area of dredge in the, this is the whole of Minamata Bay. The area of dredge is the blue cropping here. The areas in terms of where the dredging materials, the solids were deposited in terms of landfill, is in the green crosshatch area. This landfill area was about 600,000 square meters. The dredged area was about 1.5 million square meters. So this was a significant impact to the local ecology in terms of environmental cleanup of a substantial amount of real estate. And part of the response in terms of the Japanese to this incident is the development of new mercury standards. The mercury standards were based on risk assessment that suggests that the level at which neurological symptoms would appear in the most sensitive adults would be about 3 to 7 micrograms per kilogram of average daily intake. A body burden that would be 15 to 35 milligrams per 50 kilogram body weight. Total mercury concentrations in the blood of 20 to 50 micrograms per 100 milliliters, or a hair concentration of 50 to 125 micrograms per gram, or part per million. Part of the law was also to establish new discharge limits in terms of water concentrations. Discharge limits are now at 5 parts per billion, or 0.005 milligrams per liter, and no allowable discharge or detection in the discharge of alkyl mercury compounds. In terms of how Japan has treated the Minamata incident and its experience in terms of mercury in the human food chain, in 1996, the 40th anniversary of the discovery of Minamata disease, a memorial was actually erected in the city of Minamata. The idea was to remember the victims, the patients, of the Minamata incident, and also to let this serve as a lesson to future generations about responsible treatment of the environment and the human food chain. What we have done as scientists is try to take the lessons we have learned in terms of risk assessment of mercury. It's unfortunate that we have to have human disease or human toxicosis to be able to develop some clear thresholds in terms of toxicosis from clinical studies. This particular graphic gives an idea of the dose reconstruction in terms of the presentation of lethality or toxicity associated with various levels of ingestion. The idea was use that information to try to establish some of the dose response relationships for methylmercury and its accumulation in humans. What has happened since that time is the various international and national organizations have come full circle to develop regulatory standards or provisional tolerably weekly intakes for mercury and methylmercury in foodstuffs. If you remember, the Joint FAO Expert Committee on Food Additives, JECFA, it recommended that any use of mercury that increases the level of mercury in food should be strongly discouraged. It also recommended a provisional tolerable weekly intake of 0.3 milligrams of total mercury per person, of which no more than 0.2 milligrams should be present as methylmercury. And so this gives us a standard for comparison. The Ministry of Health and Welfare in Japan was a little bit more conservative given their history. They set the tolerable intake for adults weighing 50 kilograms as 0.25 milligrams rather than 0.3, and of methylmercury as 0.17 milligrams. Now, the follow-up to some of our learnings ended perhaps in or continued in 1998 with two well-designed and well-executed cohort studies in the Seychelles and the Faroe Islands. These were child development studies of populations that consumed large quantities of seafood because of their island location. The studies determined via food analysis what the prenatal methylmercury exposure, and they ascertained the neurodevelopment outcomes of the children following delivery, and this is a multi-year follow-up. The exposure levels in the two populations, these are two independent studies. The exposures were similar. The mean was 4 part per million in Faroes and 6 part per million in the Seychelles. The Seychelles study examined their main cohort, which was 779 children, five times following birth at 6.5, 19, 29, 66, and 107 months in terms of their neurological development. The Faroe Sea cohort was examined at 7 years and again at 14 years. So a different sort of examination profile in these two studies. In terms of the findings, they were divergent. They were different in that 46 in the Seychelles studies, the primary endpoints across five ages, only one of the endpoints showed a possible adverse association with prenatal methylmercury exposure. In the Faroes, it reported adverse association between prenatal methylmercury exposure and tests of memory, attention, language, and visual and spatial perception measured at 7 years old. In some cases, the divergent test results were actually occurred on identical test measures. And so we had two independent studies with some divergence of findings. Part of that had to do with, in post-analysis, an examination of other vectors of intoxication, dealing with large seafood consumption, such as organochlorine consumption and some of the neurotoxic effects of organochlorine. So these are some of the confounding associations in terms of a dietary study for methylmercury. The development of a methylmercury reference dose has been an area of debate over the past decade or so. The Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, ATSDR, National Research Council, National Institutes of Environmental Health, reviewed all of the available methylmercury studies. The US EPA recommended a reference dose lowering from what then was current at 0.5 micrograms per kilogram body weight per day down to 0.1 micrograms per kilogram per day. The National Research Council convened a study panel. They concurred with that EPA reference dose recommendation in the year 2000. The Seychelles data was discounted because no significant adverse effects were reported. The Faroes group did report there some PCBs and some whale meat that may have confounded mercury exposure. There are some questions about the NRC's conclusion in terms of was available science used in the best way possible, and what is the regulatory balance between the precautionary principle and limitations in terms of dietary restrictions on methylmercury. There are some significant challenges in the determination of various public policy issues associated with mercury in the human food chain. It's a potent neurotoxin with increased bioavailability, and therefore the government needs to be involved in public health protection. The problem right now is one of what the number should be in terms of managing the risk of methylmercury. There is a focus to try to limit mercury in vaccines from thimerosal. There's some concern about dental amalgams, although most research suggests that this concern is unfounded. And there is still an ongoing concern and precautionary advice relative to the consumption of some of the predatory fish species during pregnancy. There are some differences in the US between agencies, FDA, EPA, and the ATSDR, in terms of what we have as low dose data quality in terms of the available research. There are some problems with fish consumption advisories, problems if in that sometimes they're just voluntary and people will eat what people will catch or what is available. There are also some public health concerns associated with vaccine safety. What's worse, a little bit of mercury or a contaminated vaccine in terms of a microbial agent. One thing that is clear in terms of general agreement is that low dose data needs to be developed, especially as part of the risk assessment process. In terms of our European counterparts, the European Food Safety Authority did have an opinion on mercury and methylmercury in food. They established in 2004 a significant study of concentrations and the European levels of mercury in food. There was a data request from six member states. They included France, Greece, Ireland, the Netherlands, Norway, and Portugal, all being large fish-eating coastal communities. There was a wide variation observed in the mercury-methylmercury concentrations in fish. The calculated mean concentration of total mercury was 109 plus or minus 850 micrograms of mercury per kilogram of food, so significant variability in mercury concentrations. Part of the problem was in the way they conducted the study. They homogenized many different types of fish to look at total dietary exposure as kind of a first go at it, referred to as European fish mash. There was perhaps a problem in terms of over or underestimating the differences in different countries, especially with regards to fish consumption practices. Some communities, some nationalities tend to eat the larger predatory fish, while some, perhaps the Mediterranean, have the smaller, lower trophic level fish as food. In terms of the European Food Safety Authority analysis results, across the countries participating in the study and the grams of fish per day consumed, you can see that Portugal and Norway are the fish-eating states in the European Union. Norway, I believe, is the largest exporter of fish to the United States. In terms of the concentrations of the methylmercury in the food products, in terms of micrograms of methylmercury per kilogram body weight per week, the mean concentrations range from a high of 1.0 in Norway to a low of 0.1 in the Netherlands in terms of how the diet, the concentration levels in the diet and the amount of fish that is consumed in the diet. The dietary exposure in terms of mean dietary exposure was significant for both in Norway and for Greece in terms of fish consumption and fish consumption of higher levels of mercury. In terms of how this data was incorporated into a risk characterization, the European Food Safety Authority suggests that the intake levels by this early analysis is close to the provisional tolerable weekly intake levels established by JECFA, which is 1.6 micrograms per kilogram body weight per week, and the acceptable intake value by the U.S. National Research Council, which was 0.7. Essentially, their risk characterization suggests that high consumption of predatory fish may exceed these tolerable intake levels, and that there is a risk in terms of potential for neurotoxicosis of the unborn and young children in terms of a subpopulation of consumers. Well, this gives us yet another incidence of a toxicant in the human food chain. This one being more graphic in terms of the presentation of actual disease from an intoxication, a very wide-scale intoxication episode in the 1950s in Japan. It's an unfortunate situation. A student asked me previously about, you know, have we evolved or had within human history had to go through all of these toxicoses to learn what practices, what food types, what hurts us, what helps us? And the answer to that is probably a very bold yes. All of this is a part of the human experience, and I would suggest that there is an unfortunate side to that human experience, but if we were to cast this in the light of good fortune, we are the beneficiaries of the generations that have preceded us in terms of managing the food system. With that, I thank you very much. We'll see you later.